for those that are just now joining us. So the handout that you got today is all of the slides from the class, even the ones we're going to do next time, and even the ones we won't even have time to do. So all the answers to all the questions are in the slides, so you have references to that. And then for what it's worth, you have my explanation with each of those as well. So you have that, so that should go in your third and that last section in your folder between the last two dividers. The first two dividers are just to protect everything, because when you have these kinds of folders, if you keep them for a while, eventually the first few pages will rub and tear out. So the dividers are just to protect that. All right, so with that administrivia out of the way, we have 68 slides to do in the next two classes. Usually we do about 15 to 17. So we need two more classes after these two classes to finish, and it ain't gonna happen. So what we're gonna do is we're gonna move as fast as we can. There's some sections that we've really kind of gone over. The problem that I have is there's some of these verses that present a unique picture. And even though it's a point that we've made before, that extra picture can really impress it on your mind. I hate it, but we're not going to be able to go over them. So I hope you'll spend some time. Make sure you read them and look at those. And then in some other time, go through and just read the Proverbs, the whole thing, front to back in order. And I think you'll find a lot of points that we couldn't even talk about, because when you see certain verses together, things will pop into your mind that you never would have thought of when we look at them out of context. So, and that's not by accident. So none of it is. So make sure that you're looking for those as well. Let's see. All right, with that being said, let's just go ahead and get into the class. So there's just a couple of questions left in pride and humility. And I want to go over this one. Let's talk about ultimate honor. This is the last section of your folder. It'll go between the last two dividers. All right, so question number six. What do the proud seek instead of honor? Let's talk about that. What is the honor that they seek?
Praise of men.
The praise of men. All right. So does that mean that honor is bad and that we shouldn't want honor? No. Whose honor should we be seeking? It's an easy one.
Self-pitch.
Okay. It's too easy. God. All right. So here's the verses I want y'all to think about. Most men will proclaim each his own goodness, but who can find a faithful man? It is not good to eat much honey. So to seek one's own glory is not glory. Let another man praise you and not your own mouth, a stranger and not your own lips. So that's good advice just in general. Even if you didn't believe in God, let other people sing your praises instead of you trying to do that. That's not going to be something that's sustainable. But why does somebody do that? They do it because that's desperately what they want. They've got to have this esteem and this honor from other people. It represents a severe insecurity in the fact that they've got to have this praise from men. If we believe in God, and if that's where our faith and that's where our hope and our trust is, then it shouldn't matter what anybody else thinks. All that matters is what God thinks of us. And if that's how we can think, and if that's how we can act, and that's how we behave, then we will be incredibly strong. Because he is. A man's pride will bring him low, but the humble in spirit will retain honor. So humility here will lead to not only honor here, but ultimately it will lead to honor from God. But the thing I want to impress upon you is honor is a good thing if you're seeking it from the right source. So look in your heart and ask yourself, whose honor are you seeking? Whose praise are you seeking? All right, we've talked about this one. We've looked at this verse already about the four things that never say enough. We've talked about the generation. This time I want you to look at it from the standpoint of pride and humility. Notice what is the fundamental fault of this generation that turns on their parents. There's a generation that is pure in its own eyes, yet it's not washed from its filthiness. There's a generation, oh, how lofty are their eyes, and their eyelids are lifted up. So they're literally sticking their nose, raising their nose, looking down on everybody. There's a generation whose teeth are like swords and their fangs are like knives. All right, so we notice that they are very selfish, very entitled, and they're constantly taking, and they're mocking their father, and they're disdaining or scorning obedience to their mother. So you see this pride is something that is kind of the final form of an entire generation that is turning on those that came before them and just seeking to devour them. So again, keep an eye out for that. That's such an extreme thing, but it begins with each individual taking this kind of reaction or stance, or the way they look at their parents and those that come before them. This is what sets that up. And when you have an entire generation of that, then it's bad. All right. Any questions about pride and humility before we move into the next section? So let's talk about righteousness and wickedness. So righteousness, wickedness, these very basic terms, but there's a wisdom associated with each of those because each of those have a distinct end that may not be obvious, especially in the right here and now. So let's talk about the treasures that wickedness and sin offer. Tell me, what are the treasures that it offers? No?
Earthly treasures and passing things.
All right. So we have earthly treasures. What else did you say?
Things that are going to pass away.
All right. Things that are going to pass away. But in contrast, the righteousness is something that is ultimately not going to pass away. So treasures of wickedness profit nothing, but righteousness delivers one from death. The Lord will not allow the righteous soul to famish, but he cast away the desire of the wicked. All right, so one of the things that we see from this right off the bat is righteousness and wickedness doesn't just have consequences in and of itself. It puts us in a different relationship with God. And so as long as we are someone who is not seeking the righteousness of God, when we go to pray to him or we go to ask for his help, he casts that away. Blessings are on the head of the righteous, but violence covers the mouth of the wicked. All right, so God takes care of them. I want you to notice what happens to the wicked. Their mouth gets covered in violence. I think the perfect picture of this is Haman. Remember when he finally everything unfolded and he's pleading for his life before Esther and the king walks in. The king says, he's assaulting my wife in my own room. And Haman opens his mouth and before he can even say anything, they put a bag over his head and they drag him out. He doesn't even get a chance to speak. And so there's a lot of people, I think this is important to understand, who are gifted with the ability to charm. They know how to talk their way out of any situation. And I think deep down, some people think that they're going to be able to talk their way out of judgment before God. And so this is a good reminder, is those kinds of people, actually not just those people, everybody, you're not even going to have a chance to explain yourself. There's not going to be a chance for excuse or some justification. You will have no ground to stand on, and you won't even have the opportunity to present. You'll just have your mouth covered and taken away. So I find that a sobering thought. A man will be satisfied with good by the fruits of his mouth and the recompense of his hands. So the righteous will have joy and peace, but the wicked not only will have destruction, they're also going to have a lifetime of dread looking forward to that. All right. So when do the wicked suffer their end and to what extent? So while the whirlwind passes by, the wicked is no more, but the righteousness has an everlasting foundation. So if you had to give one word to this destruction, what would it be? How would you describe their destruction?
Unexpected.
All right, good.
Swift.
Swift. All right, one more.
Eternal.
Eternal. I was going to say complete, but that's the same thing. This is a, not just a piecemeal, just like, oh, it's a little bit. No, this is something that's going to happen suddenly, swiftly, unexpectedly, and incompletely. All right, so the fear of the Lord prolongs days, but the years of the wicked will be shortened. The righteous God wisely considers the house of the wicked. So again, another picture of God standing as judge, looking over society, looking over people, and in this case, overthrowing the wicked, not because he doesn't like them or because they look funny or they come from a bad, because of their wickedness. This is something that they choose and something they bring on themselves. So quickly, suddenly, sooner rather than later, and it gets worse from there. So let's talk about this for a second. When a righteous man falters, he's comparable to what, or comparable?
Polluted spring.
A polluted spring. All right. Explain that to me. What does it mean that he's like a polluted spring?
He uses the spring or the well there, and that's typically a source of clean water, clean refreshment. It's pure. But when it's polluted, it's ruined. You don't want to drink out of it.
Right.
Even just a little bit of something mixed in with all that water is going to completely ruin the taste and maybe even make you sick.
All right, very good. Libby?
And it's almost like a surprise. You're going to the spring to expect clean water, and then all of a sudden you're getting this dirty water.
Yeah, so it's a disappointment, right? A severe disappointment. All right, very good. So a righteous man who falters before the wicked is like a murky spring in a polluted well. So the idea is that they're not only literally unclear, but there's this false, disappointing hope of quenching and satisfying. So here's what I want you to keep in mind as you're going through life. If you're trying to be a righteous person and then you falter in this, it's going to have two very negative consequences. there's going to be people that are looking for some reason to blaspheme God, as God said to David, you've given enemies of the Lord an occasion to blaspheme. And they're going to seize upon that and they're going to say, ha ha, see, righteous aren't so righteous after all. They're just a bunch of hypocrites. So when you falter in that way, some people are going to seize that and they're going to use that as a stick to beat everybody, even God, over the head. When the other thing is those that are trying to do what's right, when they see that, then that's going to be a source of discouragement. I mean, like, oh, no, not that person. I never thought. Not him, not her. So you can be a great source of discouragement and you can give false hope to the wicked. So be very careful about that. All right, 2 Samuel 12:14 in the case of is the reference to God telling David that he had given great occasion to the enemies of the Lord to blaspheme. And so he lost the child in that case. All right, in what things may the wicked mistakenly place their confidence, and what will be the sure confidence of the righteous? All right, quickly we'll run through this one. Wickedness often build their confidence on riches and wealth and their schemes by being wicked. They plan to overthrow or accomplish whatever they want. But here's what I want you to notice, and this is one of the, I think, important takeaways. The wicked flee when no one pursues, but the righteous are as bold as a lion. I don't know about you, but I want to be that second guy. I want to be as bold as a lion. I don't want to be somebody who's running away when there's nobody even chasing me. But that is the consequence of choosing the path of wickedness, is you always have to look over your shoulder, whether it's God or whether it's somebody else who's coming after you. There's always something for you to worry about. So back to the example of the lies, right? You got to keep all those lies together and to make sure that they all harmonize with all the different things you've been telling all the different people. That's just one example. Again, just always having to look over your shoulder. But when all you say is the truth and all you fear is God, then you can be as bold as a lion. All right, so that's a beautiful picture, and I find it very attractive, and I hope it'll be also pleasing to you and something that inspires you. So wickedness is spiritually, psychologically unsettling, and it produces paranoia. I think this is even the warning here that Moses gave the children of Israel. He said, your sins are going to find you out. This is not something that you're going to get away with. And in the back of our minds, we all know that. And when we try to get by with stuff, we're always having to live under the fear. Is today the day that everyone finds out that I become exposed? So the righteousness don't have to worry about that. All right, questions, comments?
Is this an excuse to be perfect all the time?
An excuse to be perfect. All right, you're going to have to explain that.
Some folks see it as that they have to be 100% perfect, otherwise they completely totally become a failure. And so they may feel as if I've got to put on a facade of perfection at all times.
So I have two thoughts. So one thing is we want to always do the best we can all the time, right? And so if we do have some kind of weakness or some kind of falter or whatever, it is going to have consequences, like we were just talking about. And so that can't be avoided. But so I think the key lesson, I'm thinking more about the last slide, but the key lesson to me is okay, then take care of those things. And if you need help, get help. I mean, that makes it that much more important. And I think this has been said before, always be looking out for ways to help other people too. So make it easy for people to ask for help. Is that where you were going? All right. All right, good. Any other questions or comments? All right. In the house of the righteous, there is much treasure, but in the revenue of wicked is trouble. The tent of the upright will flourish, in contrast to the house of the wicked being overthrown. So ultimately, this is something that's going to destroy the wicked, where the righteous are able to look forward to flourishing, again, leading to greater confidence for both of them, that one path is going to lead to their destruction, and they have some confidence of that, so they have fear of that, whereas the other person has the promise. All right, so what mechanism ironically destroys the wicked and blesses the righteous?
Their very actions.
So the wickedness is what destroys the wicked, and the righteousness of the righteous is what saves them or helps them. Righteousness guards him whose way is blameless, but wickedness overthrows the sinner. The wicked man does deceptive work, but he who sows righteousness will have a sure reward. A righteous life leads to life, so he who pursues evil pursues it to his own death. The righteousness of the blameless will direct his way aright, but the wicked will fall by his own wickedness. The righteous of the upright will deliver them, but the unfaithful will be caught by their lust. So the very thing that people actually choose, I want to be righteous, I want to do what God says, I want to please him, I want to do what I want to do, and I don't care what the consequences are, and I don't care what God says about that. That choice, those very choices are the things that actually save us or actually destroy us. By choosing something other than what God has chosen, we actually bring destruction on us. So how does this work? The wicked is ensnared by the transgression of his lips, but the righteous will come through trouble. The violence of the wicked will destroy them because they refuse to do justice. All right, so these choices have natural consequences. And our character, this is also going to limit our behavior as well. And what ends up happening is this prevents the wicked from doing the things that are necessary to save them from their consequences. In other words, I get into trouble. I'm a very wicked person. It would be very easy for me to get out of if I would just humbly repent. If I would just humble myself and say, I'm sorry, I really messed up and I don't know why I did that. I shouldn't have done that. Please forgive me. I'll make it right. I'll even come and repay and do whatever. But if I'm choosing my own way, I'm driven by arrogance, by pride, these things that we've already looked at already. And those characteristics prevent me from humbling myself. And so I cannot avoid destruction because my very character prevents me from doing the things that are necessary. So I want you to see that this is something that is more than just a character. It's more than just a virtue. It's more than just a choice with consequences. This is something that from beginning to end, it is entirely woven together. And these very basic choices lead to very long-term consequences. And there's no way to separate them because it's the very nature of things. It becomes the very nature of us. The unique thing is we get to make that choice. But that choice has very long-term, far-reaching consequences. All right. Whoever causes the upright to go astray in evil way, he himself will fall into his own pit. Again, God's designed things that even when the wicked try to destroy the righteous, it ends up falling back on them. So Balaam's a great example of that. Somebody who wanted to get rich and he was determined to find some way to curse the Israelites, and he finally figured out a way to do it. Let's get the Israelites to disobey God, turn on God, so then God becomes their enemy. Aha, now we can finally get the Israelites destroyed. Well, it worked to a certain extent, but after it was over with, those that were righteous and resisted, God said, okay, you go take care of the Midianites who came after you. And guess who was killed in that slaughter? Balaam. So he got his wealth, but he got a lot more than he bargained for. All right, so the righteousness, or the righteous, is delivered from trouble, and it comes to the wicked instead. Evil pursues sinners. All right, that's a pretty interesting picture. Again, the idea of the lion chasing you. But to the righteous, good shall be repaid. A good man leaves an inheritance to his children's children, but the wealth of the sinner is stored up for the righteous. So a couple other things I want you to see is that God often steps in and things end up being swapped. Even the wicked that we were talking about, they have this short-term reward, and then they're gone, and then it ends up going to the righteous instead. The righteous end up leaving an inheritance for their children, for their grandchildren. So that's a long ways off, but it's something for you to start thinking about. What kind of inheritance do you want to leave for your descendants, for your legacy? What's going to follow you? What are you storing up for them? All right. By transgression, an evil man is snared, but the righteous sings and rejoices. So one of the pictures from Jehoshaphat back in the Chronicles, when he was being attacked by multiple nations, and God said, I'm going to take care of you. So Jehoshaphat got the army ready because God said, you got to go out to meet him. He got the army ready and he put his bravest, strongest, most weaponized, most formidable people in the front. The singers, the priests, and the Levites, and the singers. That's who led his army. And so they went out singing praises to God, and God was literally turning the armies against them and making them fight each other and was just clearing the path in front of them. And I think that well depicts the picture of God taking care of the righteous and the righteous being able to advance with tremendous confidence, singing and praising God as they go. So again, this is something that I want to be able to look forward to, but this is something that can only come to me and come to you if we're the righteous. All right. So we kind of touched on this a little bit. The wicked end up, oftentimes their plans backfire. It ends up actually helping the righteous and saving them. There's a lot of examples going through scripture of wicked people ending up helping other people that were righteous. So Abner, uniting Saul's army with David, and he ends up being killed by Joab. Joab takes out both Ahab's house and Baal. Actually, that's supposed to be Jehu, not Joab. But that's another good example of a wicked person doing something that helped the righteous. And then we have, just looking at the nations and the empires, just one wicked nation coming in after another, taking out one of those and bringing salvation to those that were being afflicted and being oppressed. And then the Jews are probably the ultimate example, a wicked people at that time. And yet they rejected Jesus, they killed him, and to what effect? Salvation from sins. So God often uses the wicked people to accomplish things that bring salvation, relief, and blessings to those that are righteous. So this is part of what's at play in God's world. All right, any questions about this? So I hope one of the things that you're seeing in this is that if this is a game that we want to play, that we cannot possibly win. That this is, unless we're on God's side. Because he's looking at all of the pieces and he's got everything under control. And if we think we're going to somehow manipulate this or use this to our advantage, it's going to always end up backfiring. And it's going to end up helping God's people instead. So I find this also a very humbling thing to go through as well. All right. What's the motivation of the wicked? Why are they wicked? In short, because they like to. They want to. To do evil is like sport to a fool. But a man of understanding has wisdom. Fools mock at sin. They make fun of it. So they think this is not, the very concept is ridiculous. But among the upright, there is favor. It is joy for the just to do justice. So why are the righteous the way they are? Because that's what they want. That's what satisfies them. That's what makes them happy. But destruction will come to the workers of iniquity. A righteous man hates lying. So the flip side is he hates the alternative. He doesn't want to have anything to do with it. But a wicked man is loathsome and comes to shame. The backslider in heart will be filled with his own ways. But a good man will be satisfied from above. All right. So, in this discussion between righteousness and wickedness and these two different paths, ultimately, why do people go down these paths? Because that's the path that they want to go. This is the one that is the most attractive and that has the things that they really ultimately want. It represents who we really are. He who keeps the commandment keeps his soul, but he who is careless of this, of his ways, will die. All right, so brings out another thing. You can't not choose. You're going to walk down one of the paths. There's no way out of this where you don't get to make a choice. If we're careless, if we don't make a decision, if we just let it happen, then we're choosing the path of death and destruction. All right. Don't be envious of evil men or desire to be with them. We don't want to be wicked and covet the catch. So there is a temptation for the righteous to covet the things that the wicked have. Oh, look what I'm missing out on. No, you're not missing out on anything, but that's the lie that the devil and so many other people are telling us. And so we have to learn to be content with what we have and realize that that's going to come to them eventually. So don't let that motivate us and turn us into the wicked. All right. How far ahead do the wicked think and plan?
Not far enough.
Yes, that actually sums it up very well. When a wicked man dies, his expectation will perish. He didn't think beyond death. Everything he was looking for, everything he was hoping for is something that would materialize in this life. He hasn't thought past death. And so when he dies, everything he hoped for is gone. So not just his plans, but anything that that he actually wanted has actually failed as well. The hope of the unjust perishes as well. So they've not thought past this. And so that is the fatal flaw. And so this represents a fundamental weakness, an oversight of the wicked in not thinking past this. All right, he who plots to do evil will be called a schemer. So does that mean they don't look ahead at all? No. They look ahead a lot. They look ahead a lot in this life, but they're just not looking far enough. So they do plot to do evil. They are schemers. And the devising of foolishness is sin, and the scoffer is an abomination to men. So they do devise. They have their own kind of devising, and they use scoffing to dismiss it. But what I want you to notice is devising in and of itself is not bad. Actually, the righteous also devise as well. They also, again, plan ahead. They look ahead. And they also have, if you will, schemes that they are also trying to work out. But the difference is they're devising mercy and truth. How can I help this person? What can I say that will encourage this other person? What can I say, what can I do that will help this other person make the right choice and not give up? Those are their schemes. That's the things that they're thinking about. Are they planning? Yes. But they're planning good things. So don't go to the other extreme and be naive. and turn your brain off and stop planning, stop devising and stop scheming. You just need to make sure that you're planning and devising righteous things according to God's prescription. All right. And then ultimately, he says, if you faint in the day of adversity, your strength is small. I like this verse too. Because at the end of the day, this is kind of like what Ephesians 6 says, having done all these things to stand, stand therefore. At the end of the day, you have to make a choice and you have to use conviction. You have to use strength to stand when the assaults come. You have your armor, you have your faith, use it and stand. It's easy to do what's right when things are going your way. The real person appears when difficulty comes, when temptation comes. So when that comes, stand. Have strength then, because that's the only strength that matters.
The visualization that comes to my mind is when Jesus walked on the sea and Peter has little faith.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He walked out on the water at Jesus' command, yet had little faith. You know, so that kind of same thought there. When right. A little bit of adversity comes along, don't pay attention to that crashing wave.
Yeah, that is a good example. And I think the truth be told, everybody that you look at and you say, man, they're strong. I wish I could be like them. There probably was a day that they fainted as well. And that their strength was small. But like Peter, they probably did some crying. And they probably wept bitterly. But then they got back up. Because God said they could and gave them that opportunity and extended his hand out to them. So if that happens to you and you find your strength small, then recognize it, accept it. And then weep bitterly if you have to, and then get up and go on. All right. The labor of the righteous leads to life, the wages of the wicked to sin. So how are these things alike? How are both of these paths both easy and hard?
It would be easy to pursue sin. It's hard to stay away from it, but ultimately it will make your life easier, whereas it's easier to follow sin, but it's going to make your life a whole lot harder.
Very good. Good summary, Isaac. So both of these paths are both easy and both hard at the same time. And it's a mistake to try to cover up one of those. You need to see all four of those. So Isaac's done a good job of explaining this. So the labor of the righteous leads to life. They've got to work at it. They're going to have to resist temptation. They're going to have to resist the scoffing and being made fun of and the emotional pressure that comes from that. That's their challenge. But then they have the blessings and the reward, both in this life, not to mention the life to come. But for the wicked, it's flipped the other way around. Short term, it's easier. But long term, they're going to end up having to work at it a lot harder. And they're going to have to pay the cost, the penalty in this life and the life to come. So they will receive their wages. All right. So the point that I want you to get from this is make sure that you see both of those. And the other thing that I want you to see is because of that, because none of the paths are easy all the way through, then what that means is the path you're on is the path that you want. You have chosen that path because there will be enough barriers that you're not going to be able to stay on that path unless you really want it. So think about that as well and make sure that when those troubles come, that you're prepared and that you stand as well. All right, we've talked about this, so quickly, what esteem, honor, and love do the wicked enjoy? He who follows righteousness and mercy finds life, righteousness, and honor. It goes well with the righteous. The city rejoices, and when the wicked perish, there is jubilation. When the righteous rejoice, there is great glory, but when the wicked arise, men hide themselves. When the wicked arise, men hide themselves, but when they perish, the righteous increase. So the last thing I want you to get out of this, beyond what we've talked about, is I don't like the idea of everybody rejoicing and having a party once I die. I mean, the idea of like the Ebenezer Scrooge, right? You die, then everybody is so happy. That's a really, really sad thought. But again, that is the picture of the wicked. I am so glad he is gone. Is that what you want people to be saying about you? If you're wicked, that's what they will say. But if you're righteous, everybody's going to be glad that not only that you're alive, but that you're here and that you're doing righteous and good things. So I think that's another picture that helps motivate us.
Verse 10 there, chapter 11, there are more humorous sayings that people have made that carry that same idea. Like, everyone has the capability of bringing a smile to your face. Someone they come in and someone they leave. We don't want to be that person who, when they leave, everyone's happy that they're gone.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Good job, Isaac. All right. Last thing I want you to see on this topic is that there, over time, there develops a mutual understanding and dislike for the other side. So eventually, I want you to see that strong emotions develop. This is not something that's obvious, especially when you're young. I would not expect it to be this way. But as people age and mature and become more convicted in the path that they've chosen, then that ends up eventually causing deeper and deeper emotions. Notice the bloodthirsty hate the blameless. Why would they care? Why would they have any emotional reaction to the blameless at all? But they don't just have a little bit. They hate the blameless. But the upright seeks his well-being. An unjust man is an abomination to the righteous. All right? So it's flipped around the other way as well. And he who is upright in the way is an abomination to the wicked. All right? So these things continue to progress until there is actually a deep emotional attachment to that. Now, I just mentioned that, so I don't want you to be naive and find that surprising when you do run into that. Why do people feel so strongly against me? Because I'm trying to do what's right. It's a natural consequence of choosing the right path. I think the reason for that is as long as you exist, then you are shedding light. You're passing judgment on them. Your very existence is a judgment against them. They need you out of the way, so you're stop probing their conscience and stop poking them all the time. Because every time they see you, they think, and it makes them angry. And so, anyway, John 15 is another, last part of John 15 is a good passage reference to explain that. So, but don't go so far. Don't let this emotional response that you eventually develop, don't let that turn you where you develop a hatred and a prejudgment against other people that you don't give them the chance to be somebody different as well. So be aware of that and don't let that, again, as Jesus said in Matthew 5, 38 through 48, love your enemies, bless those who curse you, and do good for those who do evil to you and spitefully misuse you. All right, any questions on this before we leave it? All right, so in the little bit of time that's left, let's talk about wisdom and folly. So we're going to move the quickest through this section. It's really the next section that I want to get to, but there are a few highlights. So what's the fundamental behavior of the wise that preserves them? We've been saying these things all along, but I love these verses, and so I want to emphasize them. A prudent man foresees evil, and he hides himself. But the simple, they pass on. They don't care. They don't notice. They don't look. And so they are punished. So are you looking down the road? A man who wanders from the way of understanding will rest in the assembly of the dead. So wisdom is foresight, practically speaking. That's what it is. It's looking down the road, seeing the end from the beginning, understanding that and making choices based off of that. So are you, again, deliberately doing this, or are you just kind of wandering around aimlessly, letting life, letting your friends, letting events just take you away? Well, then that last verse is from you. This is not something that's going to go well. Make sure that you're foreseeing deliberately and deliberately hiding yourself. And so are you listening to those who have already gone down the road? Or are we, like James talked about, looking in the perfect law of liberty, looking in that mirror, seeing the flaws, and then passing on, doing nothing about it? All right. So what fate awaits those who receive instruction versus those who are resistant to it? Again, we've covered this, but just a lot of really good verses. The wise in heart will receive commands, but a prating fool will fall. He who keeps instruction is in the way of life, but he who refuses correction will go astray. He who loves instruction loves knowledge. He who hates correction is stupid. All right, so there's our fundamental virtue again about humility, being able to submit ourselves and be able to be taught by other people. All right, last few ones. Rebuke is more effective for a wise man than 100 blows on a fool. Fools cannot learn. It doesn't matter how many times you hit them over the head. They're not going to learn. Strike a scoffer and the simple will become wary. Rebuke one who has understanding and he will discern knowledge so we can learn from the mistakes of others. Folly is joy to him who is destitute of discernment, but a man of understanding walks uprightly. The way of fool is right in his own eyes, but he who heeds counsel is wise. All right. Last few pictures, the way of life winds upward for the wise. Think about the winding staircase. You can't always see where you're going, but you know it's going up. So you just stay on the staircase. He who gets wisdom loves his own soul, but he who keeps understanding will find good. All right. So that finishes question 2. We'll pick up with question 3 next time. Make sure you go ahead and finish all the way to the end because we're going to do the best we can to finish in the next class. All right. Thank you for listening. And thank you for your preparation, and I will see you all next time for the last time.